We are in Revelation 11. This chapter has been a little bit of a dilemma for me because there's so much content that I could and kind of want to share in the first couple verses. So I wrestled with this for a long time this week on what I should set our pace for today. And my thought was, well, if I cut back on some of those things I want to share about the first couple verses, then we can get those first couple verses done. We can move through and cover more of the chapter and hopefully even get through the chapter. But the more I sat on that, the more I thought about that, and I just didn't feel good about it because I think the first two verses are important. I admit it's a little scholarly. It's not your typical come to church and, you know, get a pep talk. A spiritual pep talk and an emotional boost so that we can send you out happy. It's more of a scholarly work. We're going to be looking at a lot of Old Testament passages and bringing those prophecies into factor in this message. But I think it's necessary. That's where I landed on this. I don't know if the Lord tricked me or not, because I got word that there was going to be a snowstorm today. And I got online and I checked that, and it was showing that it was going to be at about 12 o'clock that it was going to begin. And I went, oh, Lord, thank you. You just made my decision for me. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get up there. I'm going to cover the first two verses. That's going to get us done early for the day. Then we're going to dismiss, and we'll have our build-up for next week as we cover the rest of the chapter. And then I kept watching the weather report, and it went from 12 to 1 to 2. So we no longer have that as a reason to only cover the first couple verses. But by the time that was all said and done, I felt really good about where I am on this, the first two verses of Revelation chapter 11 today. I will tell you, this is a parenthetical chapter, as is the next chapter, Revelation chapter 12, and they work exactly the opposite. It's a parallel chapter, but one doesn't start that way and the other one doesn't end that way. Revelation chapter 1 starts in the tribulation timeline. So we're going to pick up. We're just going to keep going as we are. But eventually in this chapter, and it's what we'll get to next week, eventually in this chapter, we're going to lift out of the chapter and we're going to start working way ahead. Because what the Lord is going to do is he's going to spend the majority of this chapter primarily focused on these two witnesses that are going to show up at the midway point of the tribulation. And I don't know, maybe it's that story is just so good that John or the Lord doesn't want to like break it up and say, okay, here's the introduction to these two witnesses. We'll come back to them in a few chapters. And then in Revelation chapter 9, near the end of the tribulation, we'll give you their finishing story. Maybe it was something that the Lord just said, you know what, let's start it right now. And then let's give that whole story because that's what it is. It starts where it's supposed to, at the midway point of the tribulation, but then the Lord gives us this chapter, assigning this chapter to complete their story, so we're going to work ahead of the timeline once we get going. Now, Revelation chapter 12 is the opposite of that. We start outside of the timeline. We start all the way back at the casting out of Lucifer from heaven, and then we follow that sort of global, universal all throughout history, struggle of Lucifer versus God, or if you will, Satan versus the Jewish nation. And eventually it's going to pop us, as I mentioned last week, right back into the timeline. But I would consider them parenthetical chapters. With that said, I'll let you know when we're departing from the timeline. It'll be next week. For right now, we're right in the timeline. Keep that in mind. And what I'm going to do is go ahead and get reading here. So follow along with me. Revelation chapter 11, verse 1. And this is John speaking, of course. Then I was given a reed like a measuring rod, and the angel stood saying, rise and measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. The angel of chapter 11 would be the same angel from chapter 10. I know this is two different chapters for us, but this is all one long-running narrative for John. He doesn't break and reset like we have. No, this is all one long-running chapter. This is the same angel from Revelation chapter 10. If that were not true, John would have indicated that for us, as he did last week when he told us about introducing us to another angel. So this is the same angel which I believe to be Jesus himself. And I can once again give you a pretty strong proof text for that if you just cheat and drop down to verse 3. This is the angel speaking that John is referring to here in Revelation chapter 11. And listen to what this angel says. He says, "And I will give power to my two witnesses." Now, does that sound like something Jesus would say, or does that sound like something an angel would say? That really settles it in my mind that this is Jesus in Revelation chapter 10 and Revelation chapter 11. But back to verse 1. Help me out a little bit, church. Where do we sit in the tribulation timeline or time period? Where do we sit in our study? We are at the halfway point. We're right smack in the middle of it. We have already studied the first 3.5 years of tribulation, and we are now working on our study of the second 3.5 years of tribulation. So some deductive reasoning here. If we're studying the halfway point of the tribulation, and John is told here in verse 1 to measure the temple, then what is the prophecy that is being given to us? Let me help you out with this. Here's some little bit of information that you need to figure out this prophecy. There is no temple right now in Jerusalem. There is no Jewish temple. So put together what you know and figure out what the prophecy of Revelation chapter 11, verse 1 is. There is no temple in Jerusalem right now, but when we get to the halfway point of the tribulation, there is going to be a temple. So the prophecy is what? That at some point between now and then, another temple is going to be built there in Jerusalem. We know that it is ready to be measured because John is told to measure it. We know that it is either completed or functional at this point. And how do we know that? Just look at the last phrase of verse 1. There are people that are worshiping in this temple. So it's either completed or it is completed enough to be functional. The first temple was Solomon's temple. It was built in 1050 BC by Solomon, of course. If you are a good Old Testament student, then you know that David wanted to be the one to build that temple. And the Lord refused. The Lord said, "Nope, David, don't you worry about that. I'm going to build you a house instead." In other words, from your lineage, the Messiah would come and salvation would be offered to all. But what David did was, though he couldn't build the temple himself, he did what he could, which was he could make the preparations for it. He could gather the materials. He could start cutting it together and getting it ready to be put together. So eventually when Solomon comes along, a lot of the work David already had done for him, and Solomon was able to lead the charge there in building that temple. It was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC. They started their attacks against Jerusalem and Israel there about 505 BC. But in 586, the Babylonians destroyed Jerusalem and the temple itself. And then 70 years later, as prophesied in the Bible, there was an exile from captivity, and Zerubbabel, Joshua, Ezra, along with 50,000 other Jews, made their way back into Jerusalem with one primary goal, and that was the temple, all hands on the temple. They weren't so much concerned about their houses, rebuilding their houses, picking out their land spots, and raising up their civilization. They were primarily focused on the temple because it was the center of Jewish life. And so in 536 BC, about 70 years later, they began building that temple. Now, that temple continued on until the days of Herod the Great. And then Herod the Great, just in 20 BC, just 20 years before Christ, began to authorize and call for the reconstruction, the refurbishment, the redoing of that temple, Zerubbabel's temple, or if you prefer, Joshua's temple, or if you prefer, Ezra's temple. It just depends on which of those characters is your favorite. And he did. He had the temple completely redone, and it was more than just like a little refurbishment, you know, sweeping some stones, getting the pressure washer out, you know, refinishing some of the gold etchings. It was way more than that. It was basically a complete overhaul of that temple, that second temple. And then it was still in the process of being completed as Jesus walked the earth. I don't know if you realize that or not. Jesus spent a lot of time in this temple, and it wasn't even done. It didn't get completed until 63 AD, quite a few years, decades, after Jesus died, rose again, and ascended into heaven. So it was finished just 7 years before it was completely destroyed in 70 AD by Titus and the Roman army in the siege of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was destroyed as well. Since that time, folks, 70 AD, there has not been a temple in Jerusalem. It was at that point where animal sacrifices stopped. From 70 AD to 2022, the temple completely gone. And that's what kind of stirred me up today as I sat here and thought about what we have here in this fellowship. We get to do this all the time. And here's a religion that is built upon animal sacrifice and all of these rituals. And to do these things, you need those temple furnishings, and you need a temple, or at very least a tabernacle, like in the Old Testament. That's how it started. They got nothing. They've had nothing for all of these years. And so it just reminds me of how privileged that we are. But now we know that in Revelation chapter 11, verse 1, there will be another temple, a tribulation temple. If you want to be biblical about things, you would call this the third temple in Jewish history, because the second temple never really did come to an end. It was just simply redone. But if you want to look at it in human terms, you could call it the fourth temple. You could consider it to be Solomon's temple, number one, Zerubbabel's temple, number two, Herod the Great's temple, number three, and then the tribulation temple, number four. But I will tell you from the biblical perspective, there's only been two temples so far, and the tribulation temple will be the third temple. That's as far as God reckons it. Now, there's a lot of scriptural proof I could give you for that, but the one that comes most readily to mind is Haggai chapter 2, verse 9, where in that prophecy, we are told that the glory of the latter temple will be greater than that of the former. That's actually a really neat story. It was a day where when things got done, there was a whole lot of noise, and you couldn't tell what the noise was about. You couldn't tell if people were happy and rejoicing because of the new temple, or if they were crying and sad because of the new temple. The reason you couldn't tell is because there was actually a mixture of both. See, here's what happened. The older people who had seen the previous temple, Solomon's temple, in all its glory, they were weeping and wailing as they looked at the new temple. They thought, this is pitiful. It's nowhere near as glorious as Solomon's temple. What a failure we've been. We've built an inferior temple. So the older generation, they were sad, but the newer generation that had not seen the glory of Solomon's temple, they were like, this is great, we got a temple. Now, I'm not going to always say that the youth are right when it comes to spiritual perspectives, but on this case, the youth was right. They were rejoicing in the privilege of what they had, a new temple. Wonderful, beautiful. But that prophecy that the glory of the latter temple will be greater than that of the former, it couldn't have been about size. It couldn't have been about grandeur and glory, because Solomon's temple outshined the second temple by a landslide. So what did the prophet mean when he spoke about the glory of this latter temple, the third temple, or pardon me, the second temple, or third temple, if that's how you reckon it, being greater than that of the first one, Solomon's temple? Well, we take that as a prophecy of Christ, because it would be this temple, yes, refurnished by Herod the Great, but it would be this temple that the feet of the Son of God would walk into and minister in, read scriptures at, talk to people, heal people. So it would be in this temple that God in the flesh would come in the flesh and be present in. And the way we figure it is, that makes this temple way more glorious than the first temple. Now, Revelation chapter 11, verse 1 is not the only verse that prophesies of the tribulation temple. It is all over the Bible. Daniel prophesied about the abomination of desolation. And you can find that in Daniel chapter 11 and Daniel chapter 12. I think it's in Daniel chapter 9 as well. Daniel chapter 9, verse 27. This is where the Antichrist declares himself to be God and demands to be worshipped there in the temple. So Daniel actually did speak about the temple by allusion. And then Jesus came and verified that and clarified that in Matthew chapter 24 when he said that the day was going to come when the abomination of desolation would be standing in the holy place. That means in the temple, declaring himself to be God. So that's another reference to a third temple, a tribulation temple, Matthew chapter 24. Paul talked about this in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, when Paul told us that the Antichrist will sit as God in the temple of God, trying to pass himself off as God. So Paul spoke about this temple as well. And now here we have it in Revelation chapter 11, verse 1. Just the verses that I gave you. That's an overwhelming consult of verses that tell us this is, from prophecy standpoint, supposed to happen. Now, you can check out the website of an institution called the Temple Institute. I think I have mentioned this in our Old Testament studies. It is a bunch of Orthodox Jews over there in the land of Israel who know that prophecy calls for the building of another temple, and they have been making preparations for exactly that for many years, actually decades. They've been raising money, and they have been building those pieces of furnishing that go into the temple, so that when they get the permission to build the temple, they will be sitting on go. Now, that requires a lot of money. I tried to look on their website and get an update of what all they have done and what they don't. But I know that several decades ago, they were at about 60% completed with all of those furnishings. Now, does anyone from our Old Testament studies remember how big the candlestick was? It was big. It wasn't just like, you know, a little candle holder. It was a big candlestick. It was a big lampstand, and it was made of solid gold. So there's a lot of money that has to go in this, but they're doing this. And then they are in the process of studying the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, and training priests. Those people with the last name Kohen, which means priest, supposedly those that can connect themselves to Levi as their ancestor. They are training them to be priests because their intention is once they get the green light to build the temple, they will be ready to go and they will rebegin animal sacrifices in Jerusalem. Now, I will tell you, initially we might think, well, that's unnecessary. The Lord doesn't want that because the sacrificial system is done. That was all typology, and Jesus fulfilled it all with his death on the cross and resurrection from the grave. True, that is true. But believe it or not, the Lord even calls for animal sacrifice from the temple that is going to be built in the millennial kingdom. Why would he do that? It's not something that is a valid system for salvation, and yet the Lord calls for that in the millennial kingdom. And I think it is more of a tribute and a memorial to that Old Testament system that pointed to what Jesus did. It's more of showing us, once again, those pictures and those types that reveal to us through rituals exactly what it was that Jesus did for us in his death. So they're ready to do that again. They're sitting on go. They're excited about it. And really, there's only one thing stopping them. So, what is stopping them? Are we going to see the temple construction start soon? Is that going to happen soon? Are we maybe going to see that get going before the rapture takes place? Will Christians see it at all? Is this something that happens after the rapture takes place? Well, I would say, to the question of is this something that we may see get started before the rapture, I would say possibly, but not necessarily, and most likely not probably. That make sense? I don't think it's really going to happen in our day. I don't think we're going to see it on this side of the rapture, because as I understand Bible prophecy, it's really something that couldn't happen until the tribulation period begins. Now, it is possible it could begin now. Something could radically change in the situation over there, and they could get this started, and we could see it. If so, man, well, I would say pack your things, but you can't take anything with you. Get ready to go, because time is near. No, I expect this to begin in sincerity after the church is raptured away and the tribulation period begins. So what is the one major obstacle to the construction of a temple in Jerusalem and the reassuming of animal sacrifices and temple worship in Jerusalem? Well, where does the temple need to sit? The temple needs to sit on the Temple Mount area. That's where all of the temples have been from beginning to end. Now, the tabernacle is not so. The tabernacle spent some time in the wilderness wanderings and in Shiloh. But as far as the temples are concerned, they've always been sitting right there in the same spot on the Temple Mount. Solomon's temple was there, Zerubbabel's, Herod's reconstruction, all of it right there on the Temple Mount area. And church, pray tell, who is it that currently controls the Temple Mount area? The Muslims. The Muslims control the Temple Mount area. When the Jews won the Six-Day War back in 1967, and they retook the land of Israel and reestablished themselves as a sovereign nation, one of the most dumbfounding things in history took place. The Israeli defense minister who led that victory, a guy by the name of Moshe Dayan, after that victory, against all sense, against all reason and explanation, dumbfoundingly allowed the Muslims to retain control of the Temple Mount area. I don't know why he did it. I don't know if it was a consolation prize or a participation trophy. You know, you guys tried. Good job. We beat you, but here, we'll let you keep the Temple Mount area. No one can explain why this happened. In fact, Moshe himself couldn't give you a reason why he did this. Has anyone ever seen pictures of the guy? Real cool guy with the eye patch. I mean, it was a wonderful victory, incredible victory, a prophetic victory, and he sealed it off by allowing the Temple Mount area to remain in the control of the Muslims. Who does that? Who wins a war and says, you know what, we'll give you this? It's incredible. I can't believe it happened. I can't explain it. No one can. Well, from that time to this day, the Muslims have been in control of the Temple Mount area. And what sits on the Temple Mount right now? Someone said it earlier. the Dome of the Rock Muslim Mosque. It's the only thing that sits on the Temple Mount area except for a little cupola that they have, but that's it. If you look at an aerial picture of it, it's just a big flat spot, the Temple Mount area, encased in the walls there with all the gates. And they control it and patrol it. If you go over there and visit, you'll be allowed in, but they watch you nervously and suspiciously, and they have some very strict rules. No worship, no praying, nothing like that, nothing religious, because it is the third most holy Muslim site in all of the world. That is a stronghold and a major obstacle for the construction of a Jewish temple. So here's some good questions. How could this possibly happen? This prophecy, though it is very consistently taught throughout the Bible, this prophecy has some seeming impossibility to it. What's going to happen? How is this going to work? Do we really believe that the Muslims one day are going to just start tearing apart the Dome of the Rock Mosque, their third holiest site in all of the world, and then just vacate the Temple Mount area and say to the Jews, we've had it long enough. We've had our share. Come on up, and you can take it. You think that's going to happen? I wouldn't encourage bets on that one. You're going to lose money. So what other options is there? Do the Jews come in there with their military and just obliterate the thing and overcome the Muslims that are there? That's a really bad solution. Because if the Jews did that, listen, you got 1.8 billion Muslims globally that would be happy to converge on the tiny nation of Israel at a moment's notice to wage war against Israel. That basically would start World War III without a doubt. There would be a whole lot of bloodshed over that decision. So having a Jewish temple on the mount there is a seeming impossibility. But has seeming impossibility ever stopped the Lord from accomplishing prophecy? No, I mean, we could give you prophecy after prophecy that at one time it was just impossible to think that it could come true. And then things changed and it came true. There's another one in this chapter where the scripture tells us concerning these two witnesses that I don't want to give away next week's study, but something happens to these two witnesses and it says that the whole world sees them. Now, there's a problem with that many years ago. They were on the streets of Jerusalem when this happened. How's the whole world going to see that? Now, before the days of satellite television and internet, that was an impossible thought. And I would imagine as a Bible teacher, you'd be tempted to get up there and preach it and say, now look, this is hyperbole for sure. The Lord doesn't literally mean that everyone in the world is going to see it. Impossible. It's a prophecy, but it's seemingly impossible. And then some years passed and satellite TV came out and the internet and YouTube. And we started to look at this verse differently. Now, the fulfillment of that prophecy is practically an afterthought. We know how the whole world's going to view this. The news stations are going to accidentally catch it. And then it's going to be put up on YouTube videos. And they'll keep trying to take them down because they censor, but people will keep putting it back up. The whole world, it's going to go viral. The whole world is going to see this. And it's the same with this seeming impossibility about the tribulation temple. We think there's no way that it could happen, but listen, this is the Lord that's predicting it, and so the Lord is going to pull this off. In fact, the Lord is going to actually use the Antichrist to facilitate this for him. In the book of Daniel, he tells us that it will actually be the Antichrist that strikes the peace treaty that will allow this temple to be built and then the reestablishment of temple worship to reassume. In other words, he'll roll into town with his coexist bumper stickers on his vehicle, and somehow he will get the Jews and the Muslims to come to terms with this and agree to this. Somehow the Antichrist will pull this off. He is going to have the whole world fooled. But more importantly, he's going to have the nation of Israel completely fooled. They will be completely buffaloed by this guy. He's going to have his arm around the nation as a friend. He's going to welcome them to the global table. He's going to fix the Mideast tensions for them. He's going to win over their enemies for them. And he will make sure that he gets this temple rebuilt for them. Why? Must be a good guy. Maybe he just flips at the halfway point. Wrong. He does this because his intentions all along are for the temple to be his temple. He's a deceiver, and he deceives the nation into thinking that he has their best interests in mind. Really, he has his own interests in mind. Isaiah chapter 28, verse 18 speaks of that peace treaty with the covenant. And in that passage, this is the way that peace treaty is referred to. It is referred to as a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. That's what the peace treaty really is. And of course, in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, Daniel tells us that he's going to make this peace treaty, this peace covenant with many for 1 week. That's a seven-year period. And then Daniel tells us, but halfway through the week, halfway through that seven-year period, he is going to break that peace treaty. And he does that and commits the abomination of desolation, which is where he assumes the temple for himself and then assumes the role of God in the temple and demands to be worshiped as God. And we will talk more about that soon, but let's read verse 2 because in verse 2, it gets real specific about boundaries, and what it does is it gives us clues as to what this is going to look like when the Antichrist pulls this off. So let's read in verse 2. Remember where we are. John is told to measure the temple, the altar, and the worshipers. And now verse 2, but leave out the court, which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles. A Gentile is anyone that is a non-Jew. Of course, we could be more specific. We know this to be Muslims. And they, the Gentiles, will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. How many years is 42 months? 3.5 years. So the Gentiles have possessed this land up to the 3.5 year point of the tribulation period, and these same Gentiles will continue to possess that land for the remaining 3.5 years of the tribulation. After that, all bets are off. Things are going to change drastically when the Lord returns. Now, I don't know if you were able to fully process everything that we just read there, but that has just confirmed that throughout the tribulation period, the Gentiles, and in this case the Muslims, will retain control of at least some of the Temple Mount area. That's what the verse has told us. For the duration of the tribulation period, that tells us that the tribulation temple and the Dome of the Rock Mosque will likely be sitting up there together, side by side, on the Temple Mount area. Now, we have some other reasons to believe this, but just making that assumption based on the verse and moving forward from that. Back in the March and April edition of Bar Magazine in 1983, a scholar by the name of Asher Kaufman began some research on the Temple Mount area, and what he was trying to do was figure out exactly where the ruins of the former temples sat. And he spent 16 years doing this, and I'm so glad he did because he made some very important discoveries. He actually uncovered, through archaeological digs, he uncovered and discovered the ancient remains of, believe it or not, the first temple, Solomon's Temple. And what he was able to do was he was able to take and identify the sections of Solomon's Temple that he had uncovered He was able to place them, and he was able to confirm the placement of those items by using the scriptures and by using the Mishnah, the Jewish writings. And he discovered in that research that Solomon's temple actually stood 100 yards north of where the Dome of the Rock was currently sitting. 100 yards north. Oh, actually, you know what? I believe it was 100 meters, which would be 300 and some feet. Okay, 300 and... I think it was 328 feet to be exact. And that was actually a pretty huge discovery, because for the first time ever, people started to change their opinion about how you could get a Jewish temple up there while the Dome of the Rock Mosque was up there. Previously, we all thought, well, it's going to have to be torn down. Tear it down. Tear down the Dome of the Rock Mosque. But this began to reshape our thoughts differently, because we realized once Asher Kaufman was able to locate the original location of Solomon's temple, and therefore Zerubbabel's temple and Herod's temple, then we realized there was actually a whole lot of room up there for the Jewish temple, and the Jewish temple could still sit exactly where it needed to sit. He further proved this out by using the Mishnah in a section of the Mishnah, Yoma chapter 5, verse 2. It declares that the high priest, when he was in the Holy of Holies, if he would peek out from the veil of the Holy of Holies, he had a straight line of sight straight through. He could peek out through the veil in the Holy of Holies, look through the holy place, peek through the curtain that hung on the door of the holy place, and see straight out through the courtyard and through the door, the curtain of the outer courtyard, and then see straight up into the Mount of Olives. It was a straight line of sight from the openings in the temple to the eastern gate of the wall that went around the whole section. And sure enough, once he figured that out from the Mishnah, it verified his research, because if you go over there today, and I've seen some people do this, I've seen some video and some photo of people doing this, where they will stand in a direct line of sight with the eastern gate, they'll look through it, and you can see from where they're standing, and in relation to that, where the Dome of the Rock Mosque sits, that there is plenty of room for the entire, almost a tabernacle, temple to be built. It's quite amazing. It's a straight shot. Now, maybe you're wondering, well, yeah, but how do we know that the Eastern Gate is currently sitting where it needs to sit? Well, that was actually proven by mistake, accidentally, in 1970. I don't know what they were doing, but they weren't supposed to do it. They were doing this at night. They were digging, and they dug right beneath the section where the Eastern Gate currently sits, and they found the remnants of the original foundation of that Eastern Gate, and it was exactly in the same spot. So when they built the new Eastern Gate, they put it right where it should be. What I'm telling you is that everything is lining up so that there could be both a Jewish temple and the Dome of the Rock Mosque up there on the Temple Mount area. If you paid attention to what we just read in verse 2, you realize that is exactly what the verse has alluded to us. You read that verse, and that verse tells you, measure the temple, the whole thing, but don't measure the court of the Gentiles, because the verse tells us that will still be under the control of the Gentiles for the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. Now, what is the court of the Gentiles? It is the outermost section of the temple construction. It's not covered. Here's what the Bible called for. The Bible called for a holy of holies, a holy place, and an outer courtyard. It never did call for a court of the Gentiles, but by the time that second temple was built, a court of the Gentiles was included, a place where Gentiles could come and hang out and, you know, kind of get close to worship, kind of get close to God, but not really because they're Gentiles, and everyone knows Gentiles can't be saved. Well, that was the thinking. So listen, as far as the land plot goes, right now on the Temple Mount area, all you really have to do is get the Muslims and the Jews to shake hands. I know, not easy. But all you got to be able to do is get them to shake hands and agree to coexist up there on the Temple Mount area. And if you do that, you don't have to disturb the Dome of the Rock Mosque whatsoever. You can get a full temple up there right beside it, just north of it, a holy of holies, a holy place, an outer courtyard. You just don't have room for the courtyard of the Gentiles, because guess what's in the courtyard of the Gentiles? The Dome of the Rock Mosque. A Gentile place of worship. So it matches up perfectly. For the first time ever, we're starting to see how actually it all comes down to that one thing. Getting the Jews and the Muslims to shake hands and agree. Ezekiel chapter 42 verse 10 hints at the fact that there will be a wall between these two structures. And I think that makes sense, because we know they are going to have to agree to this. There's going to have to be a peace treaty, but I don't think we want to force things and press issues. So I think a wall is good there between the two of them, just to make sure that, you know, things don't get out of hand. So how's it going to happen? It is all going to come down to the Antichrist bringing about this somehow, the solution that no one else has ever been able to come up with for the Jewish and Muslim tensions over there in the Middle East. He's going to solve it. And I guarantee you there's going to be a temple sitting up there at some point in the near future. I'm pretty sure the Dome of the Rock Mosque is still going to be there. I can't say that for sure with biblical authority, but I do know there is going to be a Jewish temple up there, and part of that Temple Mount area is still going to belong to the Gentiles, Revelation chapter 11, verse 2, and all because of the suave and sly and cunning work of the Antichrist that is going to join these two hands together. Now, we're going to close with the only part of these two verses that I haven't addressed thus far. Anyone know what it is? Good. You all think I'm more thorough than I really am sometimes. Here's what we didn't address. In verse 1, John was given a reed to use as a measuring stick, and he was told to measure the temple, the altar, and that makes sense. You got a measuring stick. Just got to find out how long that stick is. You can go around the temple. You can measure that. The altar, even easier. Measure yourself around the altar. But he told us one thing in there that kind of sits awkwardly. John was also told to measure those that worship there. Did you catch that? How do you measure worshipers? Like, are we talking, you know, get height charts and waist sizes for all of them? You know, this guy's 5'8", waist of 36. No, I don't think that's what we're talking about. I think we're talking about much more significant when it comes to worship, when it comes to measuring worshipers. And I don't think we should be caught off guard by the language, because the Lord has always done this. The Lord has always measured worshipers that come into his house for the purpose of worshiping. The word measure in the Bible is often used as a term to measure intention, purpose, and commitment. And I think that's exactly what the Lord is talking about here. Naturally, I thought of the story of the widow who cast in her two mites into the temple treasury. It's found there in Mark chapter 12. It's also in Luke chapter 21, but I want to just read a few verses from Mark chapter 12. This is verses 41 through 44. Now Jesus sat opposite the treasury and saw how, again, if you remember from our Luke study, not what they were giving, but Jesus was watching them, and he saw how the people put money into the treasury, and many who were rich put in much. Then one poor widow came and threw in two mites. That's two copper coins, less than a penny. So he called his disciples to himself and said to them, "Assuredly, I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all of those who have given to the treasury." And they must have been thinking, "Are you sure, Lord? I mean, I'm not real good at math. I'm just a fisherman. But are you sure that adds up? Doesn't seem to add up to me. That's not what I saw." Jesus goes on to say in verse 44, "For they put in out of their abundance, but she put in out of her poverty all that she had, her whole livelihood." So they put in big bills, but they had bigger bills behind that. It wasn't a sacrifice to them. This widow who just threw in two copper coins, which was practically worthless to someone of any kind of wealth, and yet the Lord saw that as an intense sacrifice because that was like bread money. You know, that was survival money. And she gave that not out of abundance or excess, but she gave that out of sacrifice. That was as deep of a sacrifice as she could have given. Years ago, there was a church that was holding a mission meeting, and the purpose for the mission meeting was to basically announce their donors and the amounts of their donors. Now, I don't recommend that, and we know that the Bible teaches that when we give, we should do that not to be seen of men. We just give secretly, as we do all of our Christian works, and then one day the Lord rewards us openly. And the Lord gave us that warning that if you do things to be seen by mankind right now, to be applauded by mankind, and you get the applause and you get the, you know, wow, you really impressed them kind of thing, then Jesus says that's your reward. That's all you get. There will be no heavenly reward for that because you've been given your reward on this earth. Well, they chose to do that. They chose to get their rewards prior to heaven. They chose to congratulate themselves. And so the moderator gets up there and he announces one by one the name of the donors and the amounts that they gave. And he started with the thousands. You know, he said, "This guy, brother so-and-so, gave $1,000. And the place just went nuts with applause. And this sister over here, she gave $1,000 too. And the place just erupted in applause again, and they worked their way down to the hundreds, and brother so-and-so gave $100, and sister so-and-so gave $100, and oh, the applause just continued, and finally they worked their way all the way down to the smaller amounts until they got to the last guy, and they announced his name, and they said he gave $1, and there was not a clap, not a single bit of applause from the people. Were stupefied. They didn't know, should we clap for that? I mean, $1? You should have just probably kept it. That's not going to help us. The moderator saw that, and sensing in his heart that the guy probably gave sacrificially, the guy probably didn't have much, and maybe that was bread money. You know, maybe that was a really deep and intense sacrifice. So he said to the crowd, the moderator said, "Shh, I believe I can hear the clapping of the nail-scarred hands." Because he got the point that Jesus does not see how we give or how we worship as we as mankind see how we give and how we worship. There's the motives and the intentions to it. Now, I know that's not something that John could measure here. And I don't know exactly how he's going to take this measurement, but I'm sure it's not about height and weight and width. I'm sure that what we're talking about here are attitudes, countenances as they come through the house of worship. The Lord sees that every week. You know that. He shows up here. He shows up here every week. I book him every week. I think I said that last week, didn't I? I book him every week. I make sure he's here. He's present. And the Lord always does this same thing in a house of worship. He's present with us. And what does he do? He watches us. He meanders through the aisles. He looks upon, peering into the hearts and souls. And he's seeing how we've come to the house of worship. He's seeing how we give in worship in the house of worship. He's seeing how we give in the offering plate. Are we thinking about what we just sacrificed and can't buy now? Or are we saying, "Lord, I'm so happy to give this to you as an act of worship"? He's monitoring all of those things. What he's doing is he's measuring us to see if we measure up in relation to what true worship is. It's such an important thing for us to think about. Every week, worship team, come on up. Every week, we probably think of we the people as the audience for God. I think there's an element of truth to that, but I think the bigger truth would be that actually the way it's supposed to work is that God is our audience. We're here to give to Him. We're here to worship Him. We're here to bless Him. This is a house of worship, a place of sacrifice. So He's to be our audience. And we think of Him on trial. At least some of the new people do. We come to church and we say, okay, Lord, prove to me why I need to be a Christian. Prove to me why I need to stay in this thing another week. Impress me. It's as if we put God on trial. God's not on trial every week here. It's us that's on trial. It's our hearts that are being evaluated. It's our worship and our giving and our praise, even our countenance that is being measured by the Lord. And it's not so that He can reject us on the quick. The Lord's not like that. It's so that He can continue to lead us into what proper worship is. In Revelation chapters 2 and 3, the Lord told every single church, He said this, I know your works. And then He went on to tell every single one of those churches what they did well and what they didn't do well. And sometimes that was painful to read about because some of those churches didn't do very well. Now, He's still in the same business. He still measures our worship in this place. And I hope when He does with you, I hope He's happy with what He finds. Now, I know you well, at least I think I do. You might have me completely fooled, but I think the Lord would be pleased when He measures you, when He evaluates your worship and your giving and your sacrifices. But if not, this would be a good verse to think about this week. This would be a good concept to get in the brain. Lord, you're really paying attention. First of all, you pay attention if I show up through those doors. Secondly, you pay attention to how I show up through those doors. You pay attention to where my heart is during worship, during offering, at the time of the giving of the word. You pay attention to all those things. You see my motives, my intentions. You see every thought that is within me. You know where I'm going with all of it. And Lord, you're either pleased or displeased. So help me to get myself into a place where in all of those evaluations and all of those measurements of my worship, you're well pleased with me. Would you stand? Omnipotent, omniscient God, Father and Creator, we bless your name today in this house of worship. We thank you so much just for the fact that we get to do this on a regular basis. You've blessed my heart with that realization today, like just a fresh revelation, as if I'd never thought of it before. I'm so overwhelmed with that. This is your place. You've established it. It exists for one purpose, and we're going to keep that purpose the same. We exist for your glory. So may you continue to pour out your glory in this place. May you continue to feed us from your word. Bless our souls and encourage us in so much that we can continue living for you and for your glory. Not just to spend this upon our own lusts and pleasures and sensuality, but Lord, to use our strength, our soundness, our wholeness to bless you with our acts of service and our hearts of worship and praise. In your wonderful name, Jesus, we pray. Amen. Mm-hmm.